Welcome to the Music Education Network for the Visually Impaired's Presentations Page podcast. I'm Jared Reimer. Taped and edited on Friday, March 30th, 2012, we have David Goldstein from the National Resource Center for Blind Musician, a division of Neighborhood Studios in Fairfield County in Bridgeport, Connecticut. In this one-hour program, David Goldstein and Jared Reimer talk about David's experiences with technology and mainly about David's program. We hope that you will enjoy this program as much as David and I had putting it together for you. And now, without any further ado, here's Jared Reimer and David Goldstein. All right, on Skype with me today for the Music Education Network for the Visually Impaired's presentations page, as well as the technology blog and podcast series on a future podcast. On Skype today, we have David Goldstein from Connecticut.
Hello.
So, David, welcome to the programs, and glad we finally got a chance to talk to you. I know that you do quite a lot of work with MENVI in particular, but you also have a program that I also thought that people who aren't a part of MENVI or who have never heard from you when this gets to the tech program might find interesting. It might be interesting to those particular people. So I thought I'd get you on and we'd talk about it a little bit. Okay. So I guess we'll start with your formal introduction and background information.
Okay, well, I'm David. I'm blind. I have a brother who's also blind. And I went to public school in Stamford, Connecticut. When I first started going to school, my state had a state school for the blind, as many states did, and there were no laws that allowed people to have a choice of whether they wanted to go to public school or not. So my parents got involved in a parents group that worked very hard to get the legislation passed, and it enabled me to go to public school for a while in a situation with a resource teacher that had a room there. And after a while, I began to have a severe hearing problem, which ended up having me go to the Perkins School for the Blind in Massachusetts. And from there, I went to do some postgraduate high school work, and then I went to college, and I majored in classical languages, Greek and Latin, and literature of various types. Then I spent a couple of years volunteering at a radio reading service where I did book reviews, and went back to graduate school and got a degree in literature and didn't end up doing too much there. So I went to a center for people who are deafblind, the Helen Keller National Center, and they got me introduced to an organization which at that time was called the Music Foundation for the Visually Handicapped, and I thought I would have a summer job there, but this is my 27th year there.
Wow. And that foundation does what?
Well, it started out, as I said, it was called the Music Foundation for the Visually Handicapped, and at that time, well, it was founded by a woman named Patricia Hart, who was a guitarist, and she had a businesswoman, and she was losing her sight from retinitis pigmentosa, and she wanted to find out what kinds of music programs there were for people who were blind and how they could be integrated into regular programs. And she discovered, number one, that there weren't any programs in Connecticut that taught Braille music. At that point, the School for the Blind was no longer doing that sort of thing. And number two, people who wanted to be involved in music were having a terrible time getting into already established programs for the mainstream. So she started the school for children and adults that first started out with music and then expanded to art and dance. And it's kind of interesting. We did a lot of pioneering work, a program for creative movements for children as sort of a substitute for physical education that they weren't getting in public school. And then they had a similar program for blind toddlers to help very little people get an idea of spatial awareness. And as the school continued, expanded into more categories of things, but then people with other disabilities wanted to become involved because they were as isolated as blind people were. And so suddenly it became a school for multiple disabilities. And later on, after Mrs. Hart left, the school expanded to cover at-risk youth in the city of Bridgeport, where the school is located. And one thing that we wanted to make sure of was that the services for people who were blind wouldn't get totally eclipsed by the other stuff. So at that time, I had been working there for about 10 years, and we decided to start what was called a National Resource Center for Blind Musicians. And through that, I do work nationally, but if there is something that somebody who is blind in Bridgeport wants to do with music, they can consult with me and I can work with the school's teachers. So it's pretty much very similar to the Southern California Conservatory in that this is a school of the arts now serving maybe 1,500 people. But my little office is available to people who are blind both nationally and within the community.
So, since you do that, why don't we get into your technology? You were talking to me about some of that earlier. So I guess we'll get into that and then get into what your center actually does for...
Okay, that sounds good. I guess, you know, I was born in 1955 and the Perkins Brailler came out in 1951, and we didn't call things technology at that point, but...
I didn't call my Braille writer technology.
Yeah, well, I mean, technology, the word for technology really just means something that gets work done. So when my brother and I were going to public school, the Perkins Brailler was, you know, the big thing to have, and there was a waiting list of a couple of years, and I think it cost about $80 originally, and then it went to $93, but that was a lot of money at that time. And so the parents group ordered Braille writers for all the children, and you know, they came in, and you know, we were really excited because actually before the Perkins, we had slates, of course, but we also had this Braille writer called the Andersen and Sorensen Braille writer that was made in Denmark. And it was an interesting thing. It was on a board, and It worked like a lot of Braille writers did in those days, where instead of a head moving along the paper like on a Perkins, the paper moved from right to left like a typewriter does, the carriage. And when you wrote a letter, it would force the paper up against pins above. And so that was kind of interesting. We had those. And then I guess the next really exciting piece of technology that came along was the reel-to-reel tape recorder. I'm not mentioning the talking book machines for the Library of Congress, which at that point were in, you know, wooden cases. But anyway, the reel-to-reel machines, they were too big to carry to school, so we never thought about using a tape recorder in school, but we started getting books from Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic on, you know, on 5.5-inch reels. And they were, and also sometimes they came on flexible sound sheets, but that the needle on the records would just about go through. But the reels were kind of okay, except if they recorded footnotes on a separate series of reels, so you'd have to take the reels off and fast forward this other tape to the notes. And of course they had the tone indexing, and so, you know, then we used that, and then the cassette machine came along, and that's when people started thinking about using technology in the classroom. When my brother went to college, he started using something called a steno mask, which was a device, I guess, used for stenographers and people doing interpreting. You could hold this thing up to your head. It sort of looked like an oxygen mask or something like that. And you could talk into it and not be heard. So he could record his notes on tape. And, you know, this was before they had, anyway, the choice was either recording the class or using a slate and stylus, or dictating your notes through a steno mask. So since I had gone to Perkins, where they expected everybody to use slates, I used my slate for taking notes for most of my courses in college. And then, you know, by the time I got to college, the talk in town was compressed speech. And it wasn't just like what you have on a Victor Reader Stream or something, where Library of Congress digital player, where you can just speed things up. There was this machine. There were several devices around, but the one I had was made by Lexicon and called the VariSpeech. And it was pretty big. It was, you know, maybe about 16 inches square, and it had a Wallensack audio visual type cassette deck on top, and a knob that, you know, you could, when you turned it, it speeded up the cassette, but it had special circuitry to compensate for the pitch. And you could hook up a variable speed device like the reel-to-reel tape recorder, and you know, turn that the speed up, and then turn the pitch down on the VariSpeech to adjust it. And you had to do it all manually. So by the time I got to my junior year of college, we saw the first talking calculator made by Telesensory Systems, which is a new company. and they had a, what they called a speech plus calculator, where the buttons were arranged like on a touch-tone phone, because they thought it would be easier for us who knew how touch-tone phones work to use numbers that way than on a, the regular calculator style. And we also started getting training on the use of the Opticon, which is a reading device for people who want to be able to actually get an idea of what the print looks like. When you move a camera along a line of print, there are 144 vibrating reeds that vibrate in the shape of the image that the camera is moving over. And it's pretty slow, but you know, we use that. I guess Kurzweil had just come out with a scanner which was about the size of a commercial copier and cost $50,000. And so that wasn't very practical, but the Opticon was about the size of a desktop cassette machine, and you could carry it around, and in some ways it was faster than scanning a page, because if you wanted to look up a number in a telephone book, by the time you found, you had to put each page on a scanner and scan the whole page before you could find out whether you were on the page with R for rhyme or whatever. And so the Opticon was faster because you could just flip through the pages and read a couple of lines and see what was on it, and also read cans and labels. And so people still use the Opticon. We're hoping that a new replacement will come along someday, because it's a valuable piece of technology for, you know, many things, like reading labels on cans and notes that are slipped under your door. But anyway,
learned. I wish I could learn how to use one, because then I could take it with me and read the printed menu. It may take me a while, but at least I'd have some idea of what I'd be getting into.
Well, what about the Kurzweil NFB reader and the Intel reader and those things?
I haven't gotten my hands on those yet.
You know, those are pretty good for reading menus, I guess, because you can hold it above the menu and it takes a snapshot of the whole page. You actually hear like a camera shutter.
Yeah.
And but I don't think I'd want to take an Opticon to a restaurant, actually.
Well, I mean, just to get an idea, I mean, I wouldn't read the whole menu, but yeah, it would be interesting to...
Yeah.
You know, well, that's actually, like, oh, this page has fish. Okay, let's see. You know, maybe then I could at least ask them, all right, I see you have fish. Do you have this? Do you have that? Then I don't have to ask them what they have.
Yeah.
I could sort of, you know, see that they serve fish, and then I could sort of narrow it down from there.
Well, from the menu point of view, one thing
just,
that's really...
Just, but, and then, you know, from the menu point of view, you could then use it to see what's on your music page, at least have an idea of what's there or what you're looking at.
Well, not only that, but wanted to do a research project in England where she needed to be able to read, or at least look at, old manuscripts and actually get an idea of the watermarks and other symbols that were on the page. And with the Opticon, she was, in theory, able to do that kind of thing. And also, it does, you know, you can really see what a music staff looks like, and how one part relates to another, and it's slow, but people have done it.
I mean, I wasn't trying to get off topic with that, you know, restaurant thing, but I it'd be, you know, then you could at least have some idea of what's there without having to read the whole menu.
Yeah, but just want to make.
Yeah, but you could all. But I was getting there too, though, David. That you could use it to sort of look at what the music's like on your paper, and you can at least be able to read what your paper is. You know, like with the title of the song at least, so that you can give it to your transcriber to Braille.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but if we're, I find the biggest thing I use the Opticon for is to check things that have come out of my printer, make sure that they're right side up or whatever, and what, you know, the pages get out of order, I can get them back in order, but with music, it's possible that, you know, when you print out your own notation, you want to see whether it came out right, and you could use the Opticon, I guess, to, you know, see whether something crazy happened, whether you've got, you know, like 15 letter lines, you know, if you've got the thing on the wrong clef or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway,
But it's an interesting piece of technology, nonetheless. I'd love to get my hands on one of these days.
Yeah. The company that made the Opticon, TSI, you know, came out with a device called the VersaBraille, which is one of the first paperless Braille devices. I think, you know, I think I got to see maybe one of the very first called the Olympha Digicassette, and that, I think, used gold in the display pins. But the VersaBraille, you know, was the first machine that really had a, got distributed. You know, there were several thousands of them produced, and my brother is a computer programmer, analyst, and so he was using the VersaBraille as a terminal mostly, and I was using it for my literature degrees and things, but there were just so many things that you could do. You know, when it first came out, it was like a word processor, but you could write your own notes and records, but you couldn't send anything in or out of it. But then they came out with one with a serial port, and suddenly we could hook it up to all kinds of different things, and you take it for granted now, but before the VersaBraille came along, really the only way that you could read what was coming out of a computer was either if you had an Opticon to look at the computer screen, or you adapted a line printer so you could have it, the computer print, write periods in the form of Braille to make dots, or you had a special thing that looked like a slate for reading punch cards. But with the VersaBraille, you could actually hook the machine up to the computer and get things in real time. And at that point, computers were more, you know, what the output was more like a teletype. So it was very linear. You'd write something, it would ask you a question, and you'd write the answer and hit return, and the next thing would come up. And so VersaBraille was really ideal for that. But, you know, whenever somebody hooked a VersaBraille up to a new kind of printer, or, you know, a new Braille embosser came out and the VersaBraille worked with it, that was, you know, real exciting news. So someone named Chris Gray started a VersaBraille users group and a magazine called VersaNews. And I got involved in editing that and actually ran and distributed the magazine for maybe 15 years, 12 years, something like that. And it was pretty exciting because TSI put a certificate in everybody's VersaBraille, giving them a 1-year subscription. So Versapro went all over the world, and VersaNews was going all over the world, and I got to meet all kinds of people that way. And so I kind of incorporated that in my work at the music school. And in like 1988 or so, we started getting interested in how computers could be used for composing music and submitting assignments to teachers. So we looked to see what was available, who was doing what with it, and we heard that a name that's pretty well known now, Mike Mandel, had figured out a way to use a program called Sequencer Plus as a screen reader. And we set up a workstation. I won't say that we were the first to develop the system because, you know, other people had done it, but I think we were one of the first to have a workstation in a school setting where somebody could come in and do some composing or print something out and take it to a teacher. We used Sequencer Plus, which is a MS-DOS program, and would save the files as MIDI files and then bring it to another DOS program called the Copyist. And then that would produce a print score. But, of course, we didn't have very much control over how the print score looked. It was just, you know, how good the MIDI file was. And so, you know, from 1988 on, I kind of was involved in seeing what was happening in the music technology field for blind people. And I got to know Gordon Kent, he introduced us to a program called Note Processor, which was another way of printing out music. You had a special code called DARMS, or D-A-R-M-S, which is actually designed by sighted people who wanted to be able to write a code for music that you could write on a regular manual typewriter using letters and numbers and things like that. And basically, the letters and numbers corresponded to the lines and spaces on a staff. I never really learned the code, but that's you know, kind of how it worked. It was funny how things come together. I put an article about the music work that I was doing, the technology, in VersaNews, and suddenly we started getting letters and phone calls from all over the country and all over the world from people who wanted to know about the system. We called it MusicWrite, but, you know, that wasn't a real name. It was just what we called it. And then the tone of the phone calls changed. We'd get calls from people who said, you know, I've been taking piano lessons and thought I was doing really well because my piano teacher would have a recital in her living room and I would play and everybody would clap and say how well I was doing. But then I'd go to college. I'm in college now and they're talking about sight reading and clefs and staves and ledger, you know, lines and hairpins, and I don't know what they're talking about. And so we ended up doing a survey to find out really what was going on in the music field. And I also wrote to the late Betty Krolik, who introduced me to Richard Tate, and somebody named Bill McCann, who was developing a program that would translate print music into Braille music. And so I got started talking to all these people in the early 90s and got to, you know, hear about what they were doing. And then, you know, Goodfeel, the Dancing Dots program, came out in 1997. And so, you know, we were one of the first to start using that. But as a result of the survey and in these phone calls, and because my school was changing and branching out to other disabilities, and then people without disabilities but with needs, either being under the category of at-risk youth or from the criminal justice system and juvenile courts, and or people who were gifted or also considered to be having special needs, we decided that what I was doing to be preserved should be under a sort of a separate division, which is called the National Resource Center for Blind Musicians. And so, you know, its basic purpose at the beginning was to deal with these calls and emails that were coming in. And finally we decided, well, maybe we should, you know, people were saying, well, you know, where can I learn all these special skills that you're saying I need? And so we decided to start a summer institute for blind college-bound musicians that would be a time where people who are already musicians could go and learn the Braille and technology skills that they needed in order to be able to matriculate successfully in the college music program or a high school AP theory program. And when we first started the program in 1996, it was Braille music and the Sequencer Plus technology, which we didn't really know that much about, that we kind of fooled around with it and making arrangements and things like that. And we had ensembles and concerts, and it was a 3-week program. But then, and we used to hold it at a university in Bridgeport. But then we realized that, you know, as much fun as ensembles and music camps were, what people really needed was a place that they could intensively study the skills that they really needed to know in order to continue. And so gradually the program evolved to a 1-week intensive that covers the Braille and technology and theory. And the first 1-week intensive we had was held at a women's college in Georgia called Agnes Scott College. And since 2004, it's been held at the Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia. We like that because, first of all, they have the music facilities and computer equipment and Braille displays and everything that we need. The only thing we have to bring is the software.
And that works for everybody.
Yeah. And the other nice thing is that they give us a dorm space, and they have drivers to pick people up at the airport. And it's also on a campus. So one of the components of the program is to give people the opportunity to experience living on a campus and traveling from place to place, which they may not have been able to do, you know, living at home, but they need to be able to get some more confidence before they go away to school.
Right.
So, you know, I've been doing the Summer Institute since 1996, And as I said, we started out with Sequencer Plus. Now the technology that we teach mainly is the GoodFeel package, particularly the Lime Allowed software that's part of it, which uses a notation editor with JAWS in Braille, the Braille display, so the result is that when you enter notes, you hear the note as a pitch, as a MIDI sound. You see it on your Braille display, and you also hear JAWS say what it is. And because you have the Braille display, you can read it as Braille music and move around and do your notation and harmonic analysis. And you can enter all your parts and then get a print copy, and using the GoodFeel program, get a Braille translation and printout. And that's what we mainly teach. But we are looking more into Sibelius, because that has, it doesn't as readily allow for Braille at the same time as you're answering the music, but it does allow you to have come out with very nice looking print scores and be able to do a professional kind of publisher quality type of music, as well as be able to move quite easily between parts. And the latest version of Sibelius has something they call magnetic something or other, which basically means that the parts won't run into each other, so you don't have to, with Lime and GoodFeel, you have to be careful. You can't tell from the Braille, but if you put too many measures on a page, you can have your parts running into each other, and so you may have to be very careful about spreading things out. So that's where we are with the technology. In the program, since I started it, we've had 85 students. We usually take about 6 a year. And several of the students, I think about 23 or so, are now in college. About 4 or 5 are in high school AP theory courses or in the band using Braille music, and a couple are in graduate school, and several are employed, maybe about 9 in various aspects of the music field, from music therapy to working in a classical music station to technology type production and then we have people who, you know, like any other person taking a liberal arts course, majoring in whatever, a lot of the music majors ended up, you know, doing other jobs, which is fine. Recently, one of our very first students, Jessica Bachicha, won the Gary Alexander International Vocal Competition first prize in the professional category, and she got to be part of a Carnegie Hall concert and have a half-hour segment all to herself.
Nice. And Jessica is a member. She joined, I think, some time ago of Menvi. So.
Yeah, several of the students are members.
So I was looking, and we have two interviews with Dancing Dots, both in 2008, and at this current time of recording, they are files 3 and 6 for your perusal, but they'll probably be moved to 4 and 7 once I get this up. So I've already sent you that link to the main podcast feed I discussed with you earlier. So if you go over to the presentations page on Menvi, you could pick up Bill McCann's interviews with me. And I've been thinking about bringing him on again because he's got this new large print thing he's doing.
Yeah, and it's called the Lime Lighter. And it allows people who have low vision to get a magnified view of a couple of measures at a time, and use a foot switch, a pedal, to move from one to another. And the screen is on a Manhasset music stand, so it's like looking at music, keep up and see where you are. And actually, the predecessors to those that device, a large share of that came from something that I was involved with, because maybe about 10 years ago, I got email on the 4th of July from somebody whose name was Thomas Green, who told me he was a retired physicist, and he was in a recorder ensemble. He had a macular degeneration and wanted to continue to play music, and he kept getting larger and larger sheets of music until he needed two music stands to hold it up. And then when the time came to turn the page, he was stuck. So he figured out a way to hook a foot pedal up to the page advance key on Finale, and wrote a few macros to be able to let the different foot pedals do different things that he needed. And he made all that information available to anybody who wanted to put together a system like that. And there were a few students who got systems like that so they could perform in their seated bands, because it wouldn't work too well for marching around with. But the Lime Lighter from Dancing Dots kind of makes a single system out of it, so we don't have to send somebody who might not be very computer savvy instructions on how to integrate like three or four different pieces of software.
So that's interesting in regards to the aspect of that program and how you were involved in it in a way. And I hope to get Bill on again. I just have to coordinate with him again like I did with you, except he's traveling all the time, so I'm trying to figure out what's best, but every time I think about it, he's on the road, so...
Well, we can get him.
I can get him if I send an email. I just haven't thought about it at the right time. But it's well and good. So that's a nice little project. And it's well worth a look, at least. So your center has been around for quite a number of years. You take...
about a little over 30 years. It's now it's changed its name. It's now called Neighborhood Studios of Fairfield County, and it really caters to the Bridgeport community. Has students come there and also works in schools. And I continue my work as a resource center, mostly by email. You know, somebody will write and say, I got a harp for Christmas and I need to find somebody who can teach me how to hold it and tune it and, you know, everything else. And maybe I can find somebody. And just last week, this week actually, got a request from somebody in California who was looking for a piano teacher for a 5-year-old child. And so, you know, that's where I decided it would be better to cooperate and collaborate with MENVI.
Yeah.
So a post to the MENVI list, but several responses. And sometimes, you know, Richard or another member will ask me about something, and I'll know about something on my end that MENVI doesn't. So we try to work together on all this kind of thing.
And that's what our network's all about. And if the list is too much for you, there is a digested mode that we or you can put yourself on, so you're not inundated with, you know, hundreds of messages, which it could be at times. So it's, you know, it is configurable with, like, most list managers. And it's a valuable network, and I'm actually glad I built the website and it's been as successful as it's been.
Yeah, I guess I should tell people that I have a website. It's called blindmusicstudent.org, and it has information about the summer program, for which there are still we're still open for receiving applications this year if people want to apply. It also has, like the MENVI page, has a page of articles and other things of interest. And I have a link to the MENVI page, and I'm pretty sure you have a link on there to mine. So
yeah, it's on our links page. It should be.
Yeah.
If it isn't, let us know and we'll rectify it right away.
Okay.
I'll send you a link to the direct page. And so you're doing that, and of course, the art. You know, you've got the, sort of like a resources page, like we do, and everything.
Yeah, and I'll get calls from my students to say, you know, I have this professor who wants me to draw diagrams of scales or something like that, and I can't explain to him how to make a that I can't make a diagram. And I said, well, I know I had a student 4 years ago who had the same kind of problem, and maybe if you talk to him, he can tell you how he dealt with it. And
I just simply tell him, look, I can't see to draw you anything. Period.
Well,
you know, I can surely try, but I'm guaranteeing you that it's not going to be what you want.
Well, I think, you know, the professor could say, well, you know, it's a requirement of my course that you do this, and if you can't do it, then you can't, you know, you shouldn't be in this department. So anyway, it's usually a way to resolve it, but sometimes it takes a little bit of networking and moral support and whatever. So,
because I'd just be frank with him. Look, I can't see. Mm-hmm. So asking me to draw you something, I can't do it. Period. You know. But I understand, you know, where you're coming from, because they could be, well, you know, we don't care. We want it drawn anyway. And we don't care how it's done. It's like, really? And you know, we're still seeing this type of problem today where, you know, professors don't want to hear what we have to say. They're so into what they want. You know, you missed that big discussion with one of our other list members. You probably got in at the tail end of that, but he was trying to figure out where he's gonna go. I think you were even asking about, you know, what he should be doing, because, you know, he's trying to get in all these different places, and, you know, nobody wants him or all of that. It's just, it's absolutely crazy. You know, and I'd figure by now, even after all of what Menvi and your agency have done, whether together or separately, that we'd have finally some kind of divide, maybe? Like, or an understanding. But there's always new professors and people coming in and you know, new schools popping up, so it's going to be a never-ending battle.
Yeah, I think what we need to, you know, do is kind of accept that fact and work with it that way. I think that it's great that we have, you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act and special student services offices and things like that, but I think one of the dangers, I'm not saying that professors are sometimes, you know, unjust and uncooperative and whatever, not understanding, but at the same time, I think we need to be vigilant ourselves and make sure that we're not taking for granted that things are going to be handed to us, because sometimes you can wait and wait and nothing happens, and then, you know, you realize that if you you're the one who needs to get it started, and I was just reading some statistics lately that even though, you know, that things are more positive than they used to be, there are fewer blind people who are becoming lawyers and, you know, breaking into the jobs that in the 70s and 80s we kind of expected that blind people would have without too much trouble. And I think part of it is that we ourselves are forgetting what we are capable of doing, and that we can do it without having to wait for somebody to help us get started.
Right. What other things would you like to pass along to our listeners before we wrap it up? Because I do know you have to get going here in a little while, so I think we should wrap it up in a few minutes.
All right.
What else? What else do you want to talk? Do you want to cover the summer program?
Yeah, I can tell you a little more about it. As I say, we have 6 students. It's probably the best student-to-teacher ratio you'll ever see anywhere. We have 4 music teachers, and then we have a director and coordinator and 3 or 4 people we call interns who help everybody out. And we have 4 blind people on the staff. 3 of them are teachers. We have 2 Braille teachers, Braille music teachers who were blind, and our computer technology teacher is blind, but our theory teacher is sighted, which is a good thing, because he actually has a doctorate in theory and teaches AP courses in a high school for the performing arts. So he knows what the expectations are, and he can look at theory books that people bring in and look at people's syllabi and see what they need to learn and how they can go about learning it. And sometimes we get into interesting discussions because we realize that a transcriber has brailled a book in a particular way that has the music down, but it doesn't put it in a way that really makes it possible to do the theory assignment. You know, the harmonic analysis things aren't lined up. It's hard to work with. And, you know, I know Richard knows all about that and takes very good care to make sure that when he does a book, you know, it comes out that way. And there are lots of other transcribers who do that, think that way also. And his articles in the CT, whatever it is. Yeah.
I can't believe they changed their name. We should get into that discussion one of these days.
Yeah, well, anyway, you know, that's coming along. So we have about 10 people on the staff for the six students. And sometimes I think they feel a little bit overwhelmed, but I think it's a wonderful mentoring process for the people who are ready for that sort of thing, because they can actually talk to people who went through music school in the same way they're going to do it. And we have some guest speakers come in, and we also try to have at least one teacher in training, somebody who may be a music teacher who has a blind student, or a teacher of the visually impaired who has a student she needs to do Braille music for. And so, you know, by spending time with us and observing the classes, and they get a much better idea of how things can be done. We actually had a student and teacher from the same school come. The student was in the band, and the teacher was the, you know, the band teacher, and so he learned how to put material into Lime and you know, learn the what made sense and what wasn't practical. And, you know, they seem to be doing really well working together now.
Cool. And that's what all of this is all about.
Yeah.
Between your project and our, well, fight to get Braille music into the hands that can use it, I see us being around for a while.
Good. We need you.
And, your program your program runs in July, right?
Yes, this year it's going to be from July 15th to the 21st.
Is that about the time that it usually is each year?
Yes, usually.
Give or take?
Yeah. Like this year it's a little bit later because of leap year. If we try to make it a week earlier, it would be running, you know, be too close to the 4th of July.
Yeah.
And so we try to keep it away from the national conventions, but it usually conflicts with something. And a lot of times people come directly from the NFB convention to our program, almost.
All right, so I think we covered everything, unless you think I'm missing something.
No, I don't think so. At least that's, you know, all I had in mind.
All right, that's sort of what I had. So let's wrap it up and give out some contact information, and thanks for coming on our program and all of that good stuff.
All right, well, my name is David Goldstein. The department I work for is called the National Resource Center for Blind Musicians, which is in a school called Neighborhood Studios of Fairfield County in Bridgeport, Connecticut. My email address is info@blindmusicstudent.org, And my website is www.blindmusicstudent.org.
Cool. And I guess we'll get you on, we'll try and get you on to have you talk about your program each year, if that works for you. At least, you know, dates and such, so there's audio, unless you just want to do it, you know, just do this one. We can talk about that later. Just thought, and if anyone who listens to this audio would like him to come, let us know. There's a contact from on the MenV page and so forth where you can let us know how we should proceed with this. I think this would be a great venture if we could do a bit of audio each year, if that's what people would like to have. So I put it out to everybody, and David, we can talk about that at a later time.
Yeah, maybe we can do it, you know, in February or March, so that people want to apply, they can hear about it.
They can hear about it. We can notate it. Yeah. You can send out the announcement to the list. I'll make sure it gets to the announcement list. We can get it into a journal. Yeah. You know, we'll sort of coordinate with our, you know, online, you know, or our news journal schedule. So we'll try and get you on at around the same time that the, you know.
Yeah.
So cool.
Uh-huh.
And
all right.
I really enjoyed having you on and learning about your technology experiences and all of that good stuff. It's been a pleasure. And thanks for coming on our program.